G'day, everyone. Quick message before we start. What we're trying to do with this podcast is to help people better understand their mind and how it works and give people practical strategies they can use to maintain and improve their mental health. Would you consider helping us to continue to do that with a financial contribution, large or small? If so, thank you. Just follow the link in the show notes. All donations $2 or more are tax deductible. G'day, welcome to Minding Your Mind. Our podcast is about your mind and how it works and mental illness and mental health. And with Professor Ian Hickey, psychiatrist and co-director of the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney. Just a few days ago, as we record this in Bondi Junction, Westfield Shopping Centre in Sydney, 40-year-old Joel Couchy, armed with a knife, killed six people before being himself shot and killed by a police officer. 23 years earlier, Couchy, who'd grown up in Toowoomba, inland from Brisbane, had been diagnosed with schizophrenia at the age of 17. He did well academically at school. He graduated from university with a Bachelor of Arts. He was on medication for schizophrenia. And then it seems in 2019 he gradually came off that medication, possibly under the supervision of his doctor. Over the next few years, he moved about in southern Queensland, slept rough sometimes, and sometimes was fed by homeless charities. Prior to what happened at Bondi Junction, he had moved to Sydney. He'd lost contact with his parents. At some points, they didn't know where he was or even if he was alive. We don't want to preempt anything, but a key moment, of course, may have been his Couchy reducing or stopping his medication. And a lot of people who are on medication for mental illnesses, sometimes severe mental illnesses, do at times think about stopping. Why do they? And if stopping medication allows at times an irrational state of mind to return, what then? So, Ian, an awful event. Are there things to be learned from it? There always are, I guess.
Yes, James. And obviously it's a very difficult topic to take head on at this point because there's a lot that we don't know. And important to say right at the start, I want to discuss issues about medication, as you said, and stopping medication and the life hits, and particularly the extent to which people's lives, isolation, discontact from family, not being able to continue with their lives may result. Important to say, however, this particular outcome of harm to anybody else is extremely rare.
Well, now, it's extraordinarily rare.
Extraordinarily rare. So let's be clear about that. And we may not know all of the factors, but probably never know, in truth, all of the factors that have contributed. That's extremely rare. But the first part of the story, which is what I would like to dwell on, is this issue of somebody who apparently presented at an early age, at 17, and received treatment. We're always talking about the importance of early intervention and that you get treatment early, and if you're in trouble, get effective treatment. Yeah. And best we know, and this is, again, a common story, apparently responded well to that. As a consequence, even though probably having a psychotic episode and attracting a diagnosis of schizophrenia, which people tend to then associate inevitably with homelessness or with bad outcomes or with drug and alcohol abuse, it's not inevitable. He did receive treatment, best we can tell, and from what's been reported. He continued with a productive life while receiving treatment. And then the common part of the story, again, is that some later period, you know, maybe around the age of 30 or so, perhaps having been on medication for a decade, inevitably saying, is this necessary? What about the side effects? Could I live my life? Could I be normal? Could I be the same as everyone else if I stopped medication?
So you said inevitably, and it seems that, yeah, it makes sense to me that if you were on quite strong medications for 10 years and they had been working, of course you would think, I mean, you know, medications sometimes have side effects. Of course you would think, perhaps now I can, for various reasons, and we'll go into
We want to go into the reasons. This is the really interesting bit, because if I said to you, right, you've got type 1 diabetes, your pancreas has failed, you will need to take insulin. Otherwise, you'll be in hospital. Otherwise, your life will be under threat. Now, many young people about the same age face this exact dilemma for something like insulin for their diabetes. Now, most of those people will go, oh, do I have to really?
There'd be a period of adjustment then they'd take it.
Huge, huge period of adjustment. And at times a bit of trial and error, a bit of risk taking. How much can I get away with? Do I really have to do that? Do I really have to stick to the rules? How far? So the doctors say in general this is what is going to happen. But most people individually go, well, is that really what's going to happen? How far can I go? Mm. I really want control over my own life. So even with really obvious things, there's a degree of that. But in the mental health area, I'd suggest there's a different thing going on, which is the society was a society we are so stuck with you're only well if you quit the medication. You're only normal again when you stop it. I see people every day in all walks of life and stories get told every day. Oh, look, I'm well now. And the proof that I'm well now is I've stopped the medication. I've recovered because I have stopped. As if taking the medication had nothing to do with actually getting well and staying well, which is a sort of denial. And this is a fabulous trope in literature and books that people write all the time. Oh, yeah, I had to get treated, but now I'm well. And the proof? I stopped the medication. And then to turn around and say, the medication didn't play a stimulant role anyway. I go, hang on a second. Let's just back up there and say, did it make a really big difference? So this sort of story commonly, and this one in particular, for people who have psychotic episodes, like really serious mental illness at an early age and get what we're all arguing for all the time, early intervention and effective treatment, apparently resulted, so it's a common story here, did well. Resumed education, started relationships, was living at home.
But is it – if you are on medication long term for schizophrenia, is it common for your doctor after a long period of time and someone living well and in a stable way to say, okay, let's do a very gradual reduction and see what happens? Or is – I mean, you wouldn't do that with insulin, obviously, because
– you wouldn't, would you?
No, but you do it with depression and you do it with bipolar in certain circumstances. Do you do it with schizophrenia or do you just say to someone, this is the sort of condition you need to be on this medication for the rest of your life. We're not doing any experimenting with reducing the dose because it will come back.
So this is where we've got to get into the specifics a bit more.
Yeah.
So we often use the terminology when someone's 17 or 18, a first psychotic episode. We don't call it schizophrenia. First episode psychosis, made very famous around the world by Pat McGorry and his colleagues in Melbourne, to not say you've got schizophrenia, inevitably for life, you have to take medication, because at 17, we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know whether it's one episode. We don't know what the course will be. We don't know how often it might recur. And we often say to people that age, look, for the next few years or in the next period, we need to be very careful because we don't know where this is going. But in the process of finding out then, let's say over that five-year period, often in association with reducing dose or with seeing what the course is. So some people have one or two episodes when they're young, and they may be in association with drug use, they may be in association with other life stresses, there may be other things going on, and they remove some of those other risk factors and things go okay.
Right.
Okay. But if people have recurrence, if people have an illness course characterized by persistence or recurrence early on, then you're into the hard issue. You're into the hard issue that when you reduce the dose, the symptoms
bad
come back.
If
the symptoms involve becoming detached from reality and not being able to make decisions again, and it's often just like the diabetes example, results in rehospitalization or results in really serious recurrence of the illness, then you're into the hard discussion. Now, look, if you stop this medication, you're likely to end up in an episode that has not only is it likely to result in things like recurrence of symptoms, but the behavior that flows may well mean you're out of home, out of school, disconnected
but
from your family.
With Couchy, I don't know that this is true, but it has been reported.
Let's just say stories like this.
Yeah. That after a significant period, 10 or perhaps even 15 years, medication was reduced with approval and supervision of a doctor.
I think we should be careful here. But let's just say it's a common thing. It's a common thing in negotiation.
But that's legitimate as a bit of trial and error.
Yeah.
But the danger
trial and error. This depends on the individual situation.
See, the danger with schizophrenia, surely, is that if you reduce the medication a bit, so draw the analogy with depression. If you reduce the antidepressants a bit, the symptoms come back. I feel really depressed again. I can't get out of bed. All right, let's ramp the medication back up. But with schizophrenia, if you reduce the medication and irrational thinking comes back, it might be too late for the person to go back on the medication because they might not rationally they might not be rational enough anymore to want to do that. Is that fair?
Yeah, so just to move away from the diagnostic bit like depression versus schizophrenia, the thing we're interested in is people's insight into their illness.
Yes, right.
And the loss of insight. So in relation, I mean, schizophrenia being the most obvious example, but other psychotic illnesses, and to some degree in severe depression and bipolar disorder, if people lose insight and come to deny that there's any relationship between the medication. In fact, the whole thing, the illness doesn't exist. They're being persecuted by the external world. It's not necessary. All sorts of things happen. Well, so a loss of contact with reality.
This would be not uncommon with schizophrenia.
So in psychotic illnesses generally. Now we'll be careful here because it's not true of all people. It's not inevitable with schizophrenia that people have lost that insight or they can't negotiate with doctors or with their family and they're involved in realizing or recognizing that medication plays an essential role. So the individual illness journey here matters. Now, in order to have the sort of negotiation you're talking about, two things you need to take into account. What has been the illness course? What are the consequences of recurring illness here? What is likely to happen in this individual from what you know over the previous 10 years? So this story is a common one, like getting treated at 17, but in your late 20s or 30s, you go, hang on a second, I've been on this stuff for 10 years, I've gained weight, I don't like it, I want to see. What happens. And the doctors would be saying, we recognise medications have long-term side effects and there are consequences and it may be reasonable in some – there's a lot of caveats here – it may be reasonable in some situations to go down the path of at least reducing the medication, not precipitously stopping the medication because of the consequences of looking at what's happening. Now, that assumes a number of things, that you're in a good relationship with a health system. A doctor. Now, whether in this situation, doesn't matter whether it's state health or private health, you're in a good relationship and you're going to turn up. You know, if things go badly, you're going to come back. And it also makes an assumption about the health system. I've seen a lot of media commentary on this week, political commentary, as if the health system, if you don't turn up, is going to go find you.
Well, this is an important point. You know, that if someone stops taking their medication and loses, you know, if they're staying with their parents or staying somewhere and they move, and they lose contact with the health system, no one's coming looking for you. No one's saying, hang on, this person has been on schizophrenia medication for 10 years. They are no longer taking it. Let's go and find him. That is not happening.
It's not happening on a variety of levels too.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard a lot of media commentary this week. Oh, of course, that doctor or that health system should have found that person.
How do you find them? GPs see 40 people a day, don't they?
Whatever. Let's just say our mental health services are very busy. Person doesn't turn up. People go, well, person didn't turn up. Now, they didn't turn up and we don't pursue them. And we also recognise that people have a right to refuse treatment.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
And also they haven't broken the law.
They haven't broken the law. There's no law that says you have to be treated.
And what are you going to do? You're going to somehow find them, send out a search party and say, oh, you should take your medication. I don't want to. Oh, okay.
So we have in all of our states and territories and most countries, laws that do have in very specific and narrow situations the right to administer treatment even if you don't want the treatment in very narrow legal forensic situations.
And we've talked about this. This is when you've been scheduled, right?
So involuntary treatment, there's an illegal process has been gone through that the threat to yourself or others is so high and it's based around threat. These are interesting. It's based around threat and harm. Mm-hmm. It's not erased around whether it's any good for you.
Right.
It also recognises even if you've got schizophrenia and if you are psychotic, you still have rights and you still may need to participate in the consent process depending on your degree of insight into the illness. So it's a really complicated thing.
Tricky balance.
And it's an important human rights kind of issue. Okay, so a lot of people are tied up with – and I'm involved in myself in other human rights issues around this about the use of so-called seclusion and restraint within these systems. We have to be very careful about overstepping the mark.
Yeah.
And in the human rights. We've got a bad track record in that historically in these areas. On the other hand, what I really like is a separate discourse, which is about the right to treatment. It's very easy to say, oh, look, you chose not to and you've got rights not to and nothing will go wrong. And by the way, the treatment's no good. The medications don't help. And by the way, clinical care doesn't matter that much. And by the way, if you end up homeless and alone and disconnected from your family, well, that's unfortunate, but it's better than getting treated. And this is a really common kind of sets of themes that are sitting under this whole area. And the really hard discussion is, really? Is that true? From whose perspective? And there's a lot of, I hate to get bang on about lawyers here, but there's a lot of legal discourse that runs that way. There's a lot of human rights discourse, which is a right of the individual. However, other people have rights too. And I'd argue the individual has a right to treatment, not a right to be ignored.
Well,
right. Yeah, the treatment systems, going back to where you were, our cancer systems, our heart systems, our other systems, our public health systems themselves. Now, of course, we saw this during COVID, of course, like about vaccination and stuff. People are very sensitive about being forced to do anything, even if there's a public good
yeah.
that arises from that. So individual rights is one thing. But there are rights here also, I'd argue, families, carers, the wider community, and the person themselves, their capacity to approach that issue. What is it okay for an individual to refuse, but what is it actually puts them at more risk? And the mental health area, for all the reasons you said at the start, is really hard.
It's really hard. Well, can we go back a step? I want to ask you about the reasons people stop taking medication, and I thought of three reasons. And the first, I think, is a basic one, self-image.
What sort of self-image? Yeah, tell me more about that.
Yeah. So the idea – so I was on antidepressants for a while, about 25 years ago.
Yep.
And what the fact that I was on antidepressants made me depressed.
Because
–
It, what did it say about you?
Yeah. Well, I guess it was a pretty old-fashioned
Is it?
View, but the fact that I wasn't capable of standing up and meeting the world on my own two feet without medication, I wanted to get back to the point where I was well and didn't need medication. So there's a self-
Yeah, but you had to row against the stream, didn't you? The whole stream of public thought and how you consider yourself relative to everyone else is, I shouldn't really need this.
Well, we'll talk about stigma in a moment, but I think they're different things.
But it's how you see yourself.
Self-image.
Well, it's what we call self-stigma.
Yeah,
a lot of stigma. I mean, on the other hand, we've discussed a lot. On the other hand, most people couldn't care less what you're taking. But
yeah,
you care yourself.
But
you do care
yourself.
So it's a self-stigma thing. It's a self-esteem thing.
I think
it's an identity thing.
I think it's very common.
Oh, it's hugely common. So I would definitely agree, the bigger problem these days is not widespread social stigma, it's self-stigma.
Mm.
A lot of other people in our wider world really don't care what you take, but you do care yourself. We're discussing with young people all the time. Young people. I have discussions with 60-year-old executives and judges and lawyers and politicians all the time.
But
oh, my God, I can't take those things.
If you just think about the language, you talk to someone who's been on – antidepressants and then isn't anymore, they will say things like, I managed to get off them.
No, I'm better.
Yeah.
I'm myself again. I was not myself.
But that feels very legitimate to me. You seem to think not.
Stop and think. What else have you got to take? I don't know about you. I got to take things to get through the world these days with the medical conditions I've otherwise got.
See, I've never had to take anything else. That's the only thing I've ever had to take.
You're a lucky bloke at your age.
Yeah.
You know, let's say those of us who have to take other stuff to get out of bed and go about our lives, right? I'm grateful those things exist that allow me in my generation. Like I still, this is hilarious, I still think of myself as being rather young and engaged with the world.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong.
That's a consequence. That is really a consequence of modern medical care.
No, but I don't think it's that binary. I think, at the time I was very grateful to have something that would help me feel less depressed. And I think people who take mental health medications
short term. Yeah, but longer term?
Well.
You just went to the thing, the identity issue.
Yeah. No, but I mean, the analogy is I've just rehabbed a knee and I had to do all these exercises.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now my knee's better and I don't have to do the exercises anymore.
Yeah, you're out the end, short-term episodes. You're going to this really you're hitting a very important nail on the head here. We all do all sorts of things short-term, have an operation, do a particular thing, take a course of this because it's the necessary thing to get out of the hole you're in.
Yeah.
You know, you've busted something, you've got to do something. But you're looking forward to the point at which it ends and you'll resume your normal self, functional, back where you were.
Yeah.
But in a lot of situations
– And I would imagine – for me and with depression, it was a thing. But if it was schizophrenia, where
but just back up, What if the depression? Every time you stopped,
then I'd
it
stay
recurred.
On him, of
would
course
you? What about the identity issue you said? How
well,
would you feel
I'd get
about
over it.
Said? Would
rather,
you?
I'd rather have a small identity issue than be depressed.
So you want one?
Well, I'd adjust that.
Well,
I'd mature
you're
and
an
learn.
See, that's me. I'm a mature learner at my age. I'm taking the stuff I need to stay to get to bed because my life – get out of bed. Sorry, not to get to bed. Get out of bed and resume my life because I enjoy my life. right? Yeah, so the transaction, no, the transactional cost is low, right?
I'm just saying ideally I wanted to get back to the point where I didn't need medication to feel good. And that felt like a victory.
Why? Why is it a victory?
Because I'm not depressed anymore, and I don't need
I don't need it. I don't need what?
I don't need a pill to
the pill.
Feel okay.
What's so bad about a pill?
It's not bad. It's just better if you don't have to take it. If you can be well.
No, but
not
here's the thing. But you start off by saying it's actually an identity thing. It's actually a
Yeah.
It's not the simple rational thing you're saying, oh, if I don't need it anymore, of course, if I don't need it, why would I?
Yeah.
It's not that. There's an identity thing sitting under there. And we hear this all the time.
Yeah.
My best self, my real self, is a medication-free self. My self-esteem goes up. I've defeated it, victorious over the depression, the cancer, the thing. I beat the thing.
But if you could beat the thing, whatever it is that you have to take – so you didn't have to take it.
I don't see it as a war against the thing. I'm really grateful the thing exists. I see it as an aid, an assistance, a thing, you know, that allows me.
Yeah, it's both, I think.
Well, I think when you're young, okay,
like
and in many areas where we have this kind of idea about ourselves, you know, robust and whatever. I think as you get older, as you said, maturity, you know, what are the things that I need to live a productive life? I'm not dependent. This idea that I'm dependent on anything, you know, the kind of idea, which is very common when people are young, but it's common in the mental health area, because, of course, mental illness is still seen as a weakness. It's seen as a flaw. Well,
but coming back to schizophrenia, we've done an episode on schizophrenia and we've talked about how there is much more acceptance in the community of depression and anxiety and employers, less discrimination against people, more support in the workplace. But if you go into a job and say, by the way, I've
had a psychotic episode or I've got schizophrenia.
Yeah, then you are much more likely to get some conscious or unconscious bias, which to me would suggest that if you're on schizophrenia medication for schizophrenia, there is possibly an even stronger urge to say, no, I want to beat that and not have that so I don't have to walk into my next job interview wondering whether to tell them about my medication or not.
This is undoubtedly true.
Yeah.
It's a whole other league of social difficulties and of explanation. So as you say, I mean, in conversations all the time, I'm sitting at dinner last night talking to a bloke about his antidepressant medication and whatever else, and we're talking about that in addition to the rugby league, in addition to, you know, Masters golf, whatever.
Yeah.
It's just one of the things that we discuss. It's just one, like, you know, it's become so common.
I love the idea of someone telling you about their depression and then, oh, he's going to score. Right. Fantastic.
Exactly. So I love this. I do love the place where people I'm familiar with and know, we can skate across all of those topics in the course of a dinner, and the antidepressant medication is no different from discussing the politics of the day or other things, right? There's no loss of social status. There's no questioning. There's no wanting to sit two chairs apart because of uncertainty, lack of knowledge, which for those who've had psychotic illness, it undoubtedly remains the case. And I see this every day. I mean, it's really good. There are people who've had psychotic illnesses who are working, work as doctors, work as lawyers. One of my favourite guys at the university comes up and tells me regularly about his schizophrenia. How's it going? Yeah. But he does say to me, I don't want you to discuss it with anyone else.
Yeah, it's
of course. So the social issue that sits around it and the what people think it is, homelessness, danger, threat, unable to live a productive life. Now, of course, this is where the medication issue becomes critical. For a lot of people with persistent psychotic illnesses, there's lots of evidence that those who stay on medication do better. Relationships, family, life. And yet there's this huge drive, personally and socially, to prove that you don't need it.
Yeah.
And lots of support, legal support, social support, support by other people who've had the illness at times. No. The medication's no good. Quit it. It's got side effects. It's bad. Hang on a second. What's going to happen if you do that and you get one of these illnesses?
Can we talk about the side effects? Because that's the third thing I wrote down is why people stop taking medication. Self-image, stigma and side effects, they are real. There's physical ones, there's mental ones for all sorts of medications, not just mental health medications, but and some medications have significant side effects, and of course every individual is different, and sometimes people get those side effects from a medication and someone else won't get them. But particularly I think for young people, when there are physical side effects, and some mental health medications can make your hair thin, and for some people, and weight gain. We're at an age where physical self-image is so important. You know, if it was me and my hair fell out, well, that horse has bolted along.
We're doing radio here at the moment.
but yes. We've also talked a lot about, for good mental health, the importance of feeling that your body, you know, that your body's in good nick, that you're in exercise, body clock going well. And so I do, you know, it's a cost benefit thing. Okay, this medication is helping my mental health, but I really hate the side effects if you are someone who gets significant ones.
So let's get this in perspective.
Yeah.
Okay, no, yeah.
So you're it becomes a cost benefit.
Yeah, but let's have a look at the size of the cost versus Now let's go down the side effects thing, because this one, if this doesn't become fairly obvious, does frustrate me a great deal. If we go back to when I started in psychiatry in the early 1980s, and the medications we'd had. Now, prior to the 1960s, we had no effective treatments for psychotic illnesses, no effective medications. So people spend long periods of time in psychiatric hospitals, in asylums, all homeless or drug addicted, or many had terrible lives. Come along the 1960s, people say institutions closed because of government policy. That is not just basically not simply true. People were leaving institutions because of the arrival of effective treatments.
Yeah.
Before anyone closed those institutions, the people not living in institutions anymore arose because of the arrival of medications that treated psychotic illnesses. And that then led into the period of, okay, what happens? Because those medications did have significant side effects that were much more dramatic. The so-called neurological side effects, the slowness in movement, the loss of facial expression, and people looked like they had Parkinson's disease. You could see people in the street who were slow and hard moving. They were young and go, what is wrong with them? And you go, they're taking those medicines. That's true. And from the 1980s to about the 2000s, from the 1960s through the sort of 1990s, that sort of period, they were, if you like, what were called the first line or first generation of antipsychotic drugs.
They've got better.
And they block dopamine and they cause Parkinsonian-like side effects. They're very hard to live with. So, but people did move from being hospitalized to living large in the community, but with a lot of side effects. So the issue then about quitting those medications and trying to reduce the dose of those medications and find alternatives. From the 1990s onwards, we've had so-called second generation antipsychotics, which have far fewer of those sorts of side effects. In fact, they don't really look like that, but they have different kinds of side effects. Two most important of which are weight gain over a longer period of time, so if you take them for a long period, and the second ones are usually are sexual side effects and other sort of difficulties. Okay, so generally over the longer term, if you're a younger person, you don't really want to gain weight or develop diabetes after 20 or 20 years or necessarily have sexual side effects or other difficulties. But what's the cost benefit here? And the extent to which in good care negotiation with doctors and others, can you reduce those? Now, we're into a period now where the weight gain, metabolic side effects, there are newer drugs again, modifications of those second generation drugs, where we're trying to manage that much better and also treat it more effectively from the start, not wait till you've gained a lot of weight and trying to find the best option. So people who are negotiating with their doctors all around this kind of stuff are trying to find, can they reduce, not get rid of completely, but reduce the impact of the side effects and live a productive life?
Yeah.
And the options now are much, much better. But it does depend on a really interactive personal relationship with healthcare systems to try and minimise these side effects and maximise the benefit.
Yeah, I guess my point is it's very easy to make
the case
in a rational cost-benefit way. And as you were talking, I was nodding along and I agree with everything you said.
But if you and I were having the argument, we'd be arguing about, in my office, we'd be arguing about this for a good half hour, an hour or a month, or three months.
If I was 21 and was concerned about how attractive I was and my hair was falling out, didn't actually happen until I was 31, thank God, and my hair was falling out and I had weight gain and maybe another side effect, and the medication was working, I can very well imagine me saying, I'm feeling better. Can I get off this stuff that is having bad physical effects?
So this negotiation, in the common areas, anxiety and depression, that conversation would be going on pretty quickly after recovering in certain periods. We'd negotiate things and reduce doses and see what happens and all that kind of stuff. In good care systems, where a person's well engaged with people who know what they're doing, where the doctor or system knows what they're doing, that negotiation's going on all the time, including reducing and potentially stopping but also continuing to monitor the situation. Yeah. Now, of course, you can, and people do, make their own choices all the time. The way they do it is go, well, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to not turn up. I'm just not going to be. I'm self-managing. I'm just going, nah, I'm not seeing that doctor anymore.
Bit like me and the dentist.
Yes. Mm. And the dentist, that's an excellent example. I'm dentist
avoidant. Well, I go when it hurts.
I love my dentist, but, you know, I'm known to be avoidant. It sends me messages.
I'm not much of a checkup guy.
Ian, you haven't been in a while. Yeah, we don't do that in the mental health. We don't do that in the healthcare sector.
Let me tell you this. Yeah. So we spoke before about how if someone decides to disconnect themselves from the mental health system, stop taking their medication, stop seeing their doctor or mental health professional, no one's coming looking for them.
Nope.
Right. So what is a better system where if someone does that, someone will – there are ways of reconnecting with them and hopefully encouraging them to take the medication that's going to help them get well again.
Well, you would hope.
If you had unlimited – not unlimited, but if you were the Minister for Health and you had a big chunk of budget.
What do you think, James? Do you think I should stand for it? You know, the independent minister – I couldn't join a political party.
I think it's easier.
The independent member –
I think it's easy to lay a platform.
Tracking. No, because God, you're a lawyer sometimes. Not anklets. Voluntarily, you and I are exchanging information all the time about your process of care. And as you muck around with medications and I'm interested and we monitor the side effects, we're in constant iteration, going backwards and forwards, trying to understand for you what's the right dose, what's the combination.
Right, but then
and
I could you up. So no, what do you do?
What did your dentist just do?
He texted me.
SMS'd you. Yeah, but
he's a great dentist, by the way.
My dentist, I love my dentist, even though I'm a terrible attendee and whatever else.
But he's not coming looking for me.
No, but they stay in contact with me. They SMS me. You haven't been in a while. They actually, my dentist of all people in his surgery, and I don't care what you see as the motivation for him doing that.
Okay, so the first line is electronic communication.
Digital.
Yeah, but what if doesn't work?
Well, these are the other negotiations that go on. But the constantly willingness of the health system to step outside of its clinic doors and it's thank God you didn't turn up.
But be more specific.
We use all sorts of electronic devices, digital devices.
So what about this? What about the GP saying, we are going to I'm happy to work with you to experimentally reduce your schizophrenia medication. Would you be willing to share your location with me?
Right. So
here's the thing, we know where you are.
Well, there are things called advanced care directives, right?
Yep.
Because if I don't turn up, if I'm no longer in contact, if I authorise you or my family or others to take the following actions, and they may include exactly that. They may include tracking me on my phone, find me. They may include sending other like community mental health teams to find me. But you've authorised that in advance.
But budget
you've agreed.
Wise, I mean, a community mental health team, right? 10 people driving off in different directions to look for me. Is that really going to happen?
No, but you just said a really important thing. We've got devices now. Forget the anklet thing.
Yeah.
You know, families track each other all the time on phones. Where are you?
Yeah, but
now, if you agree to that,
you can turn that off.
You can.
Very easily.
No, but that's true. Of course, at various levels, you can disengage. I mean, I can ignore my dentist SMSs, okay? I can take no notice. Yeah. On the other hand, I quite like the fact the dentist, despite the fact I'm the world's worst patient, cares about the state of my teeth.
And it's equal worst.
When I go back, he doesn't, or they, them, don't reprimand me too severely. Right. They go, Ian, I know you don't really like people playing with your teeth. And I know you've had bad experiences. This is true. I know you've had bad experiences with dentistry in the past. I understand why you're not here. But now, Jesus, good, you're back.
Yeah.
And now we're going to try again. We're going to try and actually stay in contact with you. It'd be really good, Ian, if you did actually come a little more frequently. And, you know, it's an ongoing negotiation. That's really interesting. Dentistry, of all things, has partly gone down that path. You know, health systems, you talk about general practice and other things. We're hopeless in chronic disease management in Australia through general practice and everything else, of actually taking care of your diabetes. Mm. In the United States, which people constantly attack as the world's worst health system, in some of those health systems, I have elderly friends there who have people contacting them all the time. James, been taking your heart medication? Because we know that from the scripts, you haven't got them filled.
Yeah.
I can't do this, but these are really nice nurses, right?
Yeah.
And the people I know.
You can make that all electronic. It doesn't have to be labor intensive.
Oh, but no.
Automatic, which is good.
The nurse knows that you're not taking your medication because the script hasn't been filled.
But I mean, the system knows, and the system can send out an automatic.
And you can consent to that. But who persuades you, an older man, to come back and resume healthcare? The digital system or the nurse who rings you up? Who you've been talking to on and off over the last 10 years about your knee, what's all the things you've mentioned, your knee, your this, your that. So you know they care. And by the way, James, we want you to do this because we don't want you to end up in hospital with your heart attack or your knee or your mental health problem, right? Mm. These are the sort of monitoring, these are all bad words. These are the interactive systems, empowering systems, but the healthcare system is proactive, is trying to prevent disaster. It isn't just simply going, oh, well, he's not here. That means he doesn't want to be here. That means he's made a choice not to, so I don't have to do anything. And I'll just wait till he turns up in the emergency department again, or guess what? He's not even in our state or territory. He's gone. Family doesn't know where he was. So our system is an uncaring, reactive, non-continuing care system.
Hmm.
It's not very smart in the 21st century.
It reminds me actually of being a legal aid lawyer. Like you'd have 20 clients on any given day at court, and if one of them didn't show up.
What do we call that?
Well, you had 19 others.
It's a bonus.
Well,
no, it is. Come on.
I mean, it made your life, it made your job 5%
easier. If you had 20 and five don't turn up, what'd you say? Good day. Because, huh? Well, I've got more time for.
But you certainly didn't go chasing him around.
No, you said I got more time for the others. Mm. In fact, if 10 didn't turn up, I got twice as much time for each one. So you put your effort into the 10 who were there.
Yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah, and you might send a letter.
And you say, I wish every day was like this. I wish every day I only had 10.
And you might send a letter to the last known address of the person. Yeah, you would.
Would you?
But you wouldn't follow it. I mean,
do you think a lot of healthcare systems do that?
No.
No. They go, oh, you've obviously made the choice. And you've got the right to make the choice. You have the right to refuse treatment. That's fine.
Mm.
So, you know, it's a very limited system. And there are really serious consequences in the area we're talking about for not continuing care often.
So the takeouts, I think, are, well, the system could be more proactive. But also in terms of medication, basically it's a cost-benefit thing. Isn't it?
The costs can be very high.
And
we as a society need to – I mean, I'm a bit worked up about this. We as a society need to say sometimes the costs are very high. Sure, there are side effects. Sure, there are consequences. Sure, there are rights. But sometimes the costs for individuals and their families are extremely high from encouraging everyone constantly to quit the medication.
I mean, I think that's putting a bit highly. Encouraging people constantly to quit.
We are as a society. You said it at the start. We're constantly saying to people in the mental health area, you are well when you don't require medication. Your self-esteem will be better. There's very rare situations. I said diabetes and you just agreed. Oh, yeah, of course there are situations. Well, guess what? In the mental health world, there are situations where a lot of people face, they really need to continue medications to be well and stay connected and function. But that's a really tough argument to be in.
Love to hear your thoughts on that. If you want to send us an email with your thoughts or with any other topics you'd like us to discuss, please do. Email address is mindingyourmind2@gmail.com, mindingyourmind2@gmail.com. Our podcast is supported by the generous philanthropic donations from families who support ongoing research into youth mental health, and further helps available from Headspace, from Beyond Blue, from Head to Health, and from Lifeline. You can just Google them, of course, or you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.